Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. They are prolific. They write page turners. They win Newbery's and Caldecott medals. They are the four terrific authors with me in the studio here this morning. And if you think I'm dazzled by their accomplishments, much less their talent, you'd probably be right. This morning, a conversation about writing, rewriting, and where do those great ideas come from? Brian Selznick won the Caldecott Medal in 2008 for his picture book novel, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, which became the 2011 film Hugo. Brian, so good to have you here again.
Hi, really happy
Welcome
to be back.
Welcome back to Kansas City.
Thank you.
Richard Peck is the winner of the 2001 Newbery Medal for A Year Down Yonder. He's also won the Scott O'Dell Award for Historical Fiction and a National Humanities Medal. Richard, nice to have you too.
Thank you very
much. Good morning. Sarah Weeks is here. She's winner of the William Allen White Award. Her best-selling Pi is currently a Mark Twain Award nominee. Sarah, nice to have you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Avi's also here. He won the Newbery Medal in 2003 for Crispin, The Cross of Lead. He's also written 70 other books. And yes, I said 70. Avi, nice to have you too here.
My great pleasure to be here.
Well, all four are in town for a special event Friday evening and tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Avi, how did all this come to be? How did you all come together here?
Well, we've had a long history. What I would say is that all of us, we talk and speak at various conferences, but the notion came about, wouldn't it be fun to basically share the stories themselves? Plus, the fact that we would work together, these are all friends of mine, I'm their friends, and work together, which is a lot of fun to do. And the notion that we could present the stories themselves in a kind of theatrical fashion intrigued us, and we created this kind of ensemble, this company, and here we are. That's what we're doing.
Well, I know you're all working with a reading reptile in addition to the library. You're in town for two programs, one at 6:30 tonight at the downtown branch of the Kansas City Public Library. That event is primarily for educators. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. There's a second event tomorrow evening for the kids, 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. And, Brian, this event is going to involve something called the Authors Readers Theater. What is that?
Well, that is the organization, the group that Avi was talking about that we've come together to create. And I think, Sarah, actually, it might be really good for you to talk a little bit about sort of how ART began and what ART's mission is as well, because I think we don't actually do a lot of these events for kids. Mm-hmm. We mostly do it for teachers and librarians at large conferences. So I think it'll be really fun to do it for kids. But the sort of theatrical presentation that Avi was talking about, where we're reading from scripts that we created from each of our own books.
Wow.
And turn them into, we're at music stands, we're all dressed in black. But, you know, there's a little bit of choreography, a little bit of theatrical flair.
Especially when you're with us, Brian.
I try. So, yeah.
Well, why don't you do this event for kids more often? What's the thinking there, Sarah?
Well, I think, you know, originally Avi was really the founder of this group, and it started with IRA, International Reading Association, and every year Avi would put a group of authors together, four authors together, to do this amazing thing, Reader's Theater. I had never heard of it before I got a call from Avi asking, you know, would you be interested in being part of it? And that was actually where I met Richard Peck also in mm-hmm. our very first presentation. And when we had finished doing this for a bunch of teachers and librarians and standing up there, it's not just about standing up there and doing the work, it's about what comes beforehand. We mm-hmm. meet to rehearse the day before, and we spend time editing each other's work, which is not something I think most authors go through, having other authors edit their work, but it's really fun, and we sort of have this camaraderie, and we do this presentation. So after we had done the IRA event, we were sitting in a van and said, you know what? We need to do this more. This is the most fun because we all travel around so much talking about ourselves and our own books. This is much more a community thing.
Well, so, more information about both events, kclibrary.org. Richard, I've got to ask, so who is the big ham? Do I hear it's Brian Selznick? Is that where we're going here?
I think there's some competition.
You aren't going to hand that title over to
I suggest lawyer. You come and decide for yourself.
Yes, okay.
But what we're doing is keeping the oral tradition alive.
Mm-hmm.
We have young readers who aren't read to at home, and nothing compensates for that. But we try to bring our stories alive to everybody.
Do you worry that parents aren't reading to their kids as much as they used to? Because in my life, that may be the best set of moments I've ever had on this planet.
I'm an old teacher, and it was perfectly clear who of my students had been read to before they went to school and who had not.
Really?
Oh, yes.
You could tell by vocabulary, by thinking, creativity, all those kinds of things?
And sensitivity far beyond books, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would jump in and say I think that reading out loud to kids is the most powerful experience in literature that you can give to a child as a gift.
Yes.
And it's hugely powerful in the sense that time and time again when you speak to older folks, and what do you remember about school? Oh, there was Miss Huntington. She used to read to us. Mr. Mal read to us. It's extraordinarily powerful.
Yes.
And when teachers say to me, and I'm sure they say that to all of us, what can I do to really help my kids read and write better? I say take voice lessons. Learn how to become a great reader.
Yeah. Well, Brian, you know, we obviously live in an age of gadgets, and I'm wondering what impact you think, as you grab, I thought you were grabbing your gadget. You know,
I'm just
wondering to what extent all of that focus is being taken away from books, and is that a concern to you or not?
I mean, it's obviously something the industry is changing, the way people experience stories is changing. But ultimately, you know, I think it's about stories and it's about this idea of sharing. And there is something that is inherently different about having a physical book in your hand where you have this thing with a certain weight where you turn paper pages.
Yeah.
And there's an intimacy to that that is just different from a tablet that, you know, turns on, turns off, has a battery.
And do you worry that's going away because kids don't gravitate towards books as quickly as they gravitate towards phones?
I don't think it's going to go away, and I think that luckily children's books in this vastly changing industry and vastly changing world right now, children's books are actually hanging on. Parents still do want to have that experience with their kids sitting and having the ability to hold these books. Like that, I think, is one place where it is still very important. But yeah, of course, it's definitely changing.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you know, I think that it's about the idea of sharing stories and reading is reading, whether it's on a tablet or whether it's on a book.
Sarah Weeks, do you worry about it, about things changing?
You know what? Someone said to me when this first started happening, they said, embrace the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to embrace it to a certain degree. And actually, what we're going to be doing tonight and tomorrow night with our program, in a sense, does embrace the technology because we have an ever-changing group of authors. It's not always these same four authors.
Mm-hmm.
We have other authors involved. One of the treats about having Brian Selznick with us is that we're going to be doing The Invention of Hugo Cabret and Wonderstruck. And when we have Brian with us, we use PowerPoint so that some of that story, some of what made those books so wonderful was that the art told a story on its own.
Yeah.
If we didn't have those pictures to show, then the audience wouldn't have the experience that they're going to have tonight and tomorrow when we do these things. So we have pictures from the book, but we're also using our voices.
Right, because how do you do a read aloud with a book that's half pictures? And so it's incorporating this technology to make that possible.
Well, how much of your decision to do Hugo Cabret and Wonderstruck with pictures and some text was based on this idea, was motivated by this idea that a lot of kids aren't reading as much as they used to, or at least you hear that?
I had no idea what I was doing when I made the invention of Hugo Cabret.
No grand scheme here.
There was no grand scheme.
Yeah.
I really liked old silent movies. You know, people told me, you know, you're making a book about French silent movies for children. That sounds like a terrible idea because kids don't watch silent movies. They certainly don't watch French silent movies. But when the book was published and it got into the hands of kids, I heard so many times teachers and parents and kids telling me that the pictures sort of carry you into the story, and suddenly you have kids reading 550 pages in 2 days. And so they feel this real sense of accomplishment. And then, of course, the book Hugo is inspired by the history of film. And so it's this technology that sort of heads right towards the technology with Kindles and e-books and movies and TV and things that we have today and what it means to look at a screen.
Yeah.
And, of course, every drawing in Hugo is designed to look like a movie screen. There's a black border around each of it. So by looking backwards, it sort of accidentally ended up heading forward.
That's interesting. Richard, when you first saw the Hugo book in Wonderstruck, did you think that concept was going to work, or did you have doubts in your mind about it?
Oh, I certainly thought it was going to work.
Did you?
Yes, because even the fact that it was black and white from the black and white era. I write historical novels, and
right.
so I hear from kids who are in love with the past and are often experts in the past in strange ways. Everybody knows about the exploding of the Hindenburg, for example, and the Titanic. And the only place to find the future is the past, and that's what we have to offer, because everything we write is historical fiction before the ink is dry, because our readers never lived in the 20th century.
Huh. What is the market for historical fiction these days when it comes to young readers? What's your sense of where that genre is these days?
Well, it would be much greater if history were being taught in school. Non-elective, sequential history and how it repeats. But they're not learning any history at school, and they're not going to learn any in college, so it leaves it to us.
What I would put, as somebody who also writes fiction, I think my own jargon for that is, truth may be stranger than fiction, but fiction makes truth less of a stranger.
That's interesting.
And I just have to say, if my husband is listening, I really appreciate the fact that you're a history teacher, and I know that you teach history in school every day. So there are some people who teach history still.
Well, and I fell in love with history, not in history class, but with Gone with the Wind and the Red Badge of Courage.
Oh, there you go. Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're visiting with four terrific children's book authors, Brian Selznick, Richard Peck, Sarah Weeks, and Avi. They're in town for a pair of events, one tonight, one tomorrow night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, two different branches. More information about those events, kclibrary.org. The event tonight primarily geared toward educators. The event tomorrow night geared more to kids 10 and younger. So lots more information about both at kclibrary.org.
Ten and older.
And also, Steve, could I also add, educators, absolutely, but all grown-ups are welcome to tonight's performance. It's just we're doing some slightly, what shall I say, dicey pieces that we wouldn't necessarily do for a younger audience. So tonight is a purely adult audience. Educators welcome, any kind of adult, bus drivers, people that love books,
so you're getting anybody. Racy tonight, Sarah, is what
we're
you're
getting
saying.
A little racy. Well, Richard,
here.
You know, we always have to hold him back with a leash.
Well, Avi, we began this show by, I pointed out, you've written 70 books, and I'm wondering, do you write with both hands, or how do you accomplish that?
Just 10 fingers. Actually, I write mostly with my right hand. How do I...
70 books.
Well, forgive me. It's as much as breathing for me. I mean, I write. If I'm not writing, I feel slightly out of kilter. Maybe it's because I have a lot of kids, and they insist upon saying they're adults, even as they sometimes need a helping hand from here to there. It's just what I do, and I've been doing it for so long.
You come from a family, generations of writers in your family, if I understand right.
That is correct, yeah. My twin sister is a writer. So
it's all heredity. It's nothing to do with talent, right?
You know, a doctor once said to me, you're in very good health. Don't take it as something you've done. You've got good genes. So there you go.
There you go. And Richard, you've written 20-some books.
40?
So you're kind of a slacker, at least, in compared to Avi. What happened to you?
I take some time off. Listen, you can get a lot written when you're unemployed.
Which is how you view it, right?
Yeah.
40 books. Mm-hmm. Do you view writing the same way as Avi just described it? You've got to be writing all the time?
I'm not writing all the time. You can't write all the time because you also have to spend time promoting it, telling people about it, doing what we're doing. If we waited for our publishers to promote us, we would die early, alone, and hungry.
And this radio program lives on authors coming in here who are just desperate to promote their books, often traveling the country on their own dime to do it.
And our readers do not read reviews. So when we get a good one, it's a bit frustrating. And they don't read catalog copy, and they don't read flap copy. So they need to see us and hear us. We have to speak for ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, one of the fun things about the ART, the Authors Readers Theater, is I had mentioned earlier that we mostly do the event for adults and educators, because the idea is that these educators who have come together for a conference can then all go back to their schools all over the country and actually do authors, readers, theater with their kids.
Oh, there you go.
So the kids then take our books, figure out how to turn them into a script, who says what, where the dialogue is, what narrative, what gets cut out. Sarah talked about us editing each other's work because we're making it into a script, because there's a difference between what you read on the page and what you say out loud that will work. And so the idea that all these teachers then go out, use our books, use other books to make these scripts where kids then feel another kind of sense of ownership. Because once you sit down and you're going through a book and you're deciding what the words are going to be that you say, that your friends say, and then you get up and you – sometimes the teachers even have the kids dress in black like we do, stand at music stands like we do. And it gives you another kind of sense of ownership, because when you read a book, it becomes yours. It's not ours anymore. I mean, once we finish the book, it's not ours anymore. It's yours. It's the kids to read. And so this idea that the adults then take the book and work this way with the kids is a really exciting way to have the kids reading and finding books that they might not have found otherwise.
So you're – go ahead, Avi.
Well, yeah. I was going to say that the origin of all this and what got me involved in this was the writer Charles Dickens, the great British novelist, who became the first entertainment celebrity in the modern world, and he did so by reading from his own books. And he read to audiences of thousands. And that always fascinated me. And I was at the Morgan Library, one of the great libraries in the world, and I looked at his manuscripts, and I realized that what he did, he took the books that made him so famous, that are so wonderful, but he altered them for reading purposes.
Oh,
and that opened the door to me as to what this is all about. These are the books that we read are our books, but they're not quite the same. They're heightened. Sometimes they're even slightly rewritten to create a dramatic effect and impact. And that's part of what Reader's Theater does. And it's, as Brian was suggesting, and Sarah has promoted this a lot, that when kids do this in school, they get inside the book in a way that they would never do in any other fashion.
So you're all about turning on the light bulbs for these kids.
Well, let me quote the great poet Robert Frost said something I always say as a preface to this. He said, "The ear is the best reader."
We want the Reader's Theater experience. I always think of our performances as like Johnny Appleseed. We are planting the seed that anybody can do Reader's Theater. We make our scripts available. Almost all of them are available on my website, and most of us have our scripts just listed there. There's no cost for it. You download it. You use it in your schools. You don't have to ask permission to use them
to
change them in any way that you want to. And it is a really wonderful experience to do Reader's Theater in a classroom, because unlike the school plays that I grew up doing, where you had to memorize lines and be all nervous on stage and have a costume and props and all that stuff, you just stand with a book and it's right in front of you, and all you have to do is become that character. And it's a really wonderful experience for kids and for grown-ups. I think you're never too old to be read to, so I'm looking forward to tonight's presentation to the grown-ups too, because grown-ups are great listeners. Uh-huh. Great, you know, some of them haven't been read to since they were kids, and they really get into it, so that's really fun.
You know, those experiences being in plays when you're a kid are so searing. I still remember my first line on a stage in fifth grade for the Thanksgiving play, which was, "I like cherries." I was so nervous, I couldn't, you know, you can't even think anymore.
That was good.
How was that, eh, Brian?
It was good.
I still have it.
Really good.
Well, Sarah, you once wrote this of yourself when it comes to the whole process of writing. You said, "Sometimes when I'm working on a book, I completely lose track of time. And when I finally stop writing, I look out the window and am amazed sometimes to find that it's dark outside." And I'm wondering, how often does that still happen to you these
days?
Not
often enough.
Yes,
Steve.
I was going to say.
I could really use a day like that right now.
Yeah. But you still can get there sometimes?
Oh, yeah. I have absolutely no control over that, though. I really, you know, I think as a writer, you just kind of have to be open to the spirits that are out there that bring you ideas, that guide you through it. I think of it as a muse, not the Sharon Stone kind of muse, but, you know, some sort of guiding spirit that says, "Okay, time to write that book now." And then it seems to happen. Thank goodness.
Richard, has it happened that way for you? Still?
Pretty much. I have to sit in the room a long time before I can hear the characters telling the story. but it doesn't start until they begin coming up with ideas and words that would never have occurred to me. And I can't say how it happens. I just know it doesn't happen in the first 6 weeks.
So you literally will sit and just ponder and think and try to get these people into your head?
Yeah, yes, and just start typing and seeing, is anybody out there?
Really?
Yes.
And oftentimes the first 6 weeks are kind of a lost adventure.
They won't say a word to me. Or I'll start with the wrong narrator. I wrote my first book from three different points of view before I found the right one. So I learned early to keep looking for the right character. The one voice my books never need is mine.
Really?
I'm the wrong age. I have the wrong vocabulary. I have the wrong memories. So I have to find a young person to tell my story, to keep me off the stage and off the page.
Hey, how do you stay connected to the minds of young people and how those minds are whirring around up there?
I have reached the age of invisibility. I can sit behind them on the bus. They don't know I'm there. I can sit in the food court next to them and sop up the rhythms of their speech. And it's the rhythm you need, not the content.
And you do that?
Oh, yes.
And you can pick up on it and sort of roll with it a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah.
Writing is the craft of listening. That's why so many young people fail.
Oh, that's interesting. Avi, are you a stalker like Richard is too?
Did I say stalker?
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, you did.
Yeah, I mean, you have to listen. I mean, Richard is 100% correct. It's notice what Sarah says and what Richard says. It's not only listening to other voices, but listening to the voices in your head and your memories of voices. And, you know, I'm working on a book right now that's set in the 1950s, and I actually was around then. And trying to go back and hear the way folks speak and, you know, other ways to go back in the past is to read people's diaries because they tend to write more as they spoke rather than in a formal way. So, yeah, I remember doing research for a book about the great westward migrations and read diaries of people passing through Kansas, if you will, and the simplicity of the way they were describing astonishing events gave me the clue to write in that fashion, in that way, in that tone, and that helped capture something of that time, I think.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, after 70 books, and please answer this question with the word yes, is it still a struggle?
Yes. It gets harder.
Does it get harder?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, your expectations, what other people expect you to do, if you want to make things hard, win a Newbery Award. Then they really want some. My first thought when they called me and told me I'd won a Newbery, this is true, the first thought I had is, oh, my gosh, the next one better be good.
Really?
Absolutely.
Well, speaking of expectations, Brian, I'm guessing you're living in that world right now after Hugo Cabaret and Wonderstruck. I mean, are you feeling pressure to reach that level again here?
Well, in one sense, I'm sort of lucky in that I always think what I'm doing is a complete failure and will not work.
And so it can't get any worse.
So it really is helpful.
I can relate a little bit to that.
And
yeah.
So I made Hugo at a point. You know, I had a very good career before I made Hugo, but things had sort of slowed down and I didn't know what I was going to do. And, you know, like I said, I was doing this weird book about French silent movies. I thought nobody was going to read it. And then luckily I had already started the idea for Wonderstruck had sort of come to me, and I was, because I finished Hugo, and even though I didn't know if anyone was going to read it, I was satisfied with it. I did feel like after the 3 years I put into it, it did become the book I actually wanted it to be, even though I hadn't seen a book like that before. I did make and if no one read it, it was like I still learned something valuable from having made it. So I thought, okay, well, what can I do next that will take what I learned from Hugo but do something different with it? And then that became Wonderstruck. So I was already underway with Wonderstruck before Hugo sort of became as successful as it became.
When did you get the first indication, I'm guessing from your editor, who called you after having looked at Hugo maybe for the first time and said, yes, this thing is going to work? Or was there a moment of epiphany where you got some good feedback and you thought, okay, this my idea might have some legs here?
I mean, my editor saw it when I basically just said to her, I think I want to do a book about this French filmmaker and a kid. Like that's as much as I had. And then, and Sarah has always been extremely helpful as I've been writing. And so I will bounce ideas off of her and I'll call her up. And also our friend Pam Munoz-Ryan is another person who I – they actually know how to write. And so they're very helpful to me in terms of what direction I'm going in. But honestly, the moment that I knew Hugo was going to work was after the book was published and I was on tour for the first time, and the first school I went to – I walked into the room and one class had gotten there early, and the book had just been published like the day before, and somehow the teacher had gotten some early copies, read them to the kids to prepare them for my talk, and one girl was sitting in that little group of kids holding my book to her chest like a treasure.
Oh, boy.
And I thought, that's when I thought to myself, this might be okay. Like, that has to be a good sign.
And you'll remember that girl the rest of your
forever,
life, probably.
Forever. Yeah. And I'm so great. She actually kind of made me cry. I saw her sitting there with that book, and I went over, because it was early and all the other kids weren't there. It was just this one class. And I was like, you guys, did you read? You read Hugo? And they're like, uh-huh. And I was like, did you like it?
You're really lowering yourself here. Right?
Oh, yeah. No. I was so terrified because, I write for kids. I know they're my audience, but I generally don't think about kids when I'm working on my books. I'm just trying to write a good story. And I went over, did you think it was good? Did you like it? And like, they really, really liked it. And I got kind of teary-eyed, and I thought to myself, Brian, you can't cry in front of these kids. Just don't cry.
You're going to freak them out, yeah.
And I just thought, because that's what we all do. Like, we sit mostly by ourselves. We have help, like I was saying, with Sarah and Pam especially. But mostly we sit by ourselves alone. You know, yeah. We all have editors who we work with, who we love sometimes, we hate sometimes, we work closely with. But it's mostly alone. And we want our audience to read our books. And so for all of us to go out and to hear that someone liked a book that we wrote is still a very profound thing.
It's also, one of the reasons I think we love doing Reader's Theater so much, because we get to spend time with each other, look at each other's books. I hear Richard's voice in my head now when I write certain characters, because I know, he'll play that part. We're doing one of my picture books, Woof, A Love Story, and Richard plays the cat. Richard plays the dog, and I play the cat. And I have a hard time not crying when we do it, because it means a lot to me.
But you sort of crave the feedback because of what Brian was saying. You're alone so much, and suddenly you can be out in front of people and interact and get some response.
Well, I think unlike Richard and Avi and Brian, I spend a lot of my time doing school visits. I do a lot of author visits. I see between 10,000 and 20,000 kids in schools every year. So I get a lot of the feedback. I'd like a little bit more of the alone time sometimes, because I spend a lot of time on the road. And perhaps that's because I am the only member here who hasn't won a Newbery or a Caldecott, though I'm very proud of my William Allen White Award.
You should be.
And that's the first time anybody ever had a parade in my honor, so that was pretty exciting, in Kansas.
Was it down in Emporia?
Yes, it certainly was.
Well,
It was very, very important to me, actually, because those awards are voted on by kids. So I do feel like I have a lot of contact with my audience, and it's very important to me, very meaningful to me.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our great conversation here with our four authors, Brian Selznick, Richard Peck, Sarah Weeks, and Avi. We'll talk a little more in our second half about editors, pro and con, and how Sarah actually helps Brian out with his own writing. We'll take your phone calls, too, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or you can tweet us @kcurupdate. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Kim Noble was not inaccurate. It is May 2nd. She is talking about snow tonight, and I want to apologize to our authors in front of us here who have traveled long and far to get here and only to find snow and cold weather. If you missed yesterday's conversations about online reputation management and Tourette's syndrome, you can find those in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. A rebound romance, struggles with modern technology, and artificial insemination are all topics confronting moviegoers this week. Tomorrow on the show, our indie foreign and documentary film critics are back to review the latest films showing on area screens. Well, this hour we're visiting with four terrific children's book authors, Brian Selznick, Richard Peck, Sarah Weeks, and Avi there in town for a pair of events, one tonight. Both at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, one tonight, primarily for educators at the Kansas City Library, downtown, 14 West 10th Street, one tomorrow night for kids 10 and older at the library on the plaza. More information at kclibrary.org. And now, Sarah Weeks, why don't you sort of introduce what you're going to do now. You're going to do a dramatic interpretation of one of your books, one of your picture books. It's titled Woof. This is kind of a sense of what's going to be happening tonight and tomorrow night, right?
Exactly. Okay. Woof, A Love Story, is a picture book, and we won't be showing the pictures tonight. We'll just be presenting the text as a reader's theater performance with the four of us playing different roles. And we're going to read it here for you guys now. You'll hear some turning of pages because, as I said, we don't memorize our scripts. We have the pages right here. And if you guys are ready.
I'm ready.
All right,
ready?
Here we go.
Here's Woof.
Woof, A Love Story by Sarah Weeks.
A dog is a dog.
And a cat is a cat.
And most of the time, it's as simple as that.
Most of the time, what a dog has in mind is doing dog things with the rest of its kind. Running and panting.
Sniffing and growling.
Rolling in things.
Digging and howling.
That is what a dog's life is. But Denver, well, this story is his.
It all began on a fine spring day. I got up out of bed in the usual way. I yawned and I stretched, then I sniffed at the air and whiffed something very unusual there.
That's when I saw him, this humongous hound, taking the steps in a single bound.
That's when I saw her way up in a tree, and something remarkable came over me.
He saw me. I thought, oh, drat pirouette, you foolishly strayed, and now here's what you get. The teeth on that dog are as long as my tail.
And under her fur, she turned terribly pale.
She was white from her tail to the tip of her nose, which was tiny and pink as a cake frosting rose.
My heart began thumping so loud in my chest, I thought lying down for a while might be best.
He simply flopped down at the foot of the tree, and he stared and he stared and he stared up at me.
Then after a minute he lifted his head, opened his mouth, and here's what he said.
I love you.
He meant to say that, I've no doubt, but woof, woof, woof was what really came out.
You're pretty, I whispered.
Grrr's what he said.
Climb down. I adore you.
I climbed up instead.
He said every flowery wallpaper word, but woof, 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 woof's what she heard.
The more that he pleaded, the more he declared, the higher she climbed. The poor thing was so scared.
And so he gave up. He was blue as the sea.
I quit,
he announced.
You don't understand me.
He turned and he left with his ears hanging low. And she wondered,
why has he decided to go?
Most dogs would attack, but he left her behind.
And she thought,
This dog must be one of a kind.
Now, whenever I'm down, nothing helps worth a fig except finding a spot and beginning to dig. I dig and I dig till my spirits are lifted, and things can turn up in the dirt that I've sifted.
Sometimes a coin or a shoe or a stone. But this time he dug up a shiny trombone.
He pulled this enormous gold thing from the ground, and he blew in the end of it. My, what a sound.
At first he just splatted and blatted about, but soon something different began to pour out.
It seems I was so full of feelings inside, so touched by this cat, it could not be denied. I blew in the stuff I was thinking about, and something or other, music, came out.
It really was something, the music he made. I understood just what he felt when he played.
I played and I played while she sat in the tree, and when I had finished, she climbed down to me. I looked in her eyes and laid down the trombone and took her sweet, delicate paw in my own.
At first she was shy, then she lifted her head, opened her mouth, and quietly said,
I love you.
No. No, what you said was, meow. But I understood what you meant anyhow.
The end.
That's Woof by Sarah Weeks, and that's a sense of what you'll be hearing tonight and tomorrow night at the Kansas City, Missouri, the branches of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. That was terrific. That may have been the highlight of our 10 years doing this show here every day. That may have been the all-time high there, I think. Absolutely.
Woof.
Let's have some Emmys.
Yes.
Woof, woof.
Our phone number here for our authors, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org. Let's go to Sally from Lawrence. Sally, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I am so excited that you have all these authors on. I think
me
about
too.
All these books that I read when I was younger, and they're still out there. I have a little box at my house of things that my daughter's required to read, and we've already read, you know, So Be It. And Are You Alone in the House? Are You in the House Alone is one that I remember reading. And so anything that I read when I was younger gets in that box, and that's what it's a required reading for my daughter.
You just made my day.
Mine too.
I called actually to thank Brian Selznick for a wonderful, thoughtful note that he sent to my daughter. She read Wonderstruck in 2 days, and when she was 9, and got done and said, oh, you just have to read this. I can't even explain it. It's so complex. And then she wrote him a long letter in orange crayon, and she made a self-portrait, an 8x10 beautiful self-portrait, and sent it to him with the note. And I found his address online and sent it. And she, every day she'd come home, did I get a letter yet? Like he was going to write her back. Well, he wrote her back a little note. And in the front, he answered her questions, and she had wanted an autograph and this and that. So he told her about using models and that his favorite color right now was orange, so thank you for the orange letter. And then he put a little arrow to his signature. This is my signature. And then it said over, and on the back he had a little picture of her, and he said, this is my picture of your picture of you. And it was so sweet, and I just wanted to, and I thought,
that,
I need to send.
I do remember actually answering this letter. Please tell your daughter I say hi.
I will, and she was so, so excited. She was just stunned when she got that, and I felt like I needed to send a thank you card to you for for being so thoughtful as to write her back, and so she's now been thinking she needs to write these other authors, and so it's kind of a new thing for her. But
okay.
she
That's
writes,
great.
She draws about 1 or 2 hours a day, and has her cartoon series that we do, and I.
Sally, that's great.
I enjoy hearing you all having so much fun with what you do.
I appreciate that, Sally. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Barbara from Overland Park. Barbara, you're on up today. Good morning.
Well, good morning, and what a great program.
Thank
I'm enjoying
you.
It so much. One of my favorite poems is called The Reading Mother by Strickland Gilliland, and it ends up with the last two lines that always get me. He talks about pirates and Ivanhoe and lots of things in the poem, but here are the last two lines. Richer than I, you can never be. I had a mother who read to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that is such a powerful kind of way to end a poem.
That's great, Barbara. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Clifton from Olathe. Clifton, you're on Up to Date with our great authors. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for Avi. I've taught sailing for years. My children are adults now, and when they were the age that I'd be reading Avi's book, Wind Catcher 2, I was curious, the boat he describes there, has he sailed that kind of boat? He doesn't describe it, name it directly in the book, but I think it's a sunflower.
I think it's smaller than a sunflower. It was basically a polystyrene cup with a sail on it.
That's a sunflower.
Oh, well, I don't know. Remember. Yeah, I did have one of those things. I think I bought it for, believe it or not, $90 with a buddy of mine, and we couldn't both fit in it, so he'd go out and then I'd go out.
That's the sunflower. We teach on those down at Lake Olathe all summer long.
Much fun.
Clifton, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
We just have about a minute left, and I'm wondering, let's do a pro and con on editors. Sarah, you talk about rewriting a lot, and I'm wondering how difficult that process is and how much help do you get from editors and how much help do you give to Brian when you guys have your conversations?
I consider rewriting a necessary evil. I
yeah.
don't enjoy it. And when I
it's
get
hard,
a manuscript, oh yeah, when I get a manuscript back and it's all full of those yellow post-it notes and red flags, sometimes I'm mad, sometimes I cry. I usually put it away for a little while, but that's where the really good stuff is, in those comments. That makes my writing better. So I do a lot of rewriting. I do between 3 and 10 drafts of every book I do, even a picture book. You might think a picture book is fast. And what Brian and I do for each other, because he also helps me with my books, is that we share in the process because we trust each other. And we know that we're very tender about our writing when it's first coming up. It's like a new shoot coming out of the ground. And so I sometimes will send him a chapter or read. I think I read you a chapter recently over the phone just to get his comments. And he's always very gentle with me. The good stuff comes first, and then comes the, maybe you might want to try this, you know?
Can you tell just by hearing her? Or, I always have to see the words on the page. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much help can you give just orally like that?
Well, in that case, it's more about the overall ideas of the chapter or the characters or the story as opposed to the specific text or lines themselves. But you can listen and be like, I missed this part of this character, or this part didn't make sense, or this was a really wonderful part. And you can get that through the language, like we've been talking about. Reading out loud makes the story work when hearing it as it's being formed.
You know, I've got to hate to end this conversation now, but we've got to end this conversation now. So thank you all so much for coming in. I want to thank Brian Selznick again, Richard Peck, Sarah Weeks, and Avi. Lots of information at the kclibrary.org website about the event tonight for educators and tomorrow night for kids 10 and older tomorrow night. So lots of information there. I really enjoyed having you guys here.
Thank you so much, Steve.
We haven't had this much talent in this room in a long time. Just terrific to have you all here.
Thank you.